My name is Mark Lund. I teach economics at Luther College, Decorah, Iowa. And this is the last part of a week-long session on global economics. The topic for tonight is Justice Begins at Home. I think what I'm going to be doing tonight is what some students started at Luther College several years ago. They would invite faculty members, this was the freshman men at Luther College, they would invite faculty members to come to their dormitory, and they'd say, we'll give you 1 hour to make a presentation, and during that hour, assume that that's the last lecture you'll ever be able to give. And so, what's really important, lay it on the line, and we'll find out what really matters. Well, what I'm going to do tonight is, even though the topic has been global economics throughout the week, I'm going to move the problems a little bit closer to home, and therefore this topic is Justice Begins at Home. I think it's a very important concept to examine justice issues right at home if you're ever going to be involved in global economics. It's just so important that whenever I finish any kind of a class on international issues, global issues, I tend to end it in this manner. I want to just summarize briefly some of the issues we dealt with on the international level before I move to justice at home. The first evening we talked a little bit about the new international economic order and the fact that when nations trade, poor nations and richer nations, that trade does not seem to be very fair. It's free trade, but it's between powers that are very unequal. And so the gains, many of the gains go to the countries that are in the north, and the poor countries don't receive many. Then the second evening we talked about the linkages between countries in the north, like North America, Europe, Japan, and the countries in the south, South America or Latin America, Africa and Asia. And we said that there tends to be a real dependency of the south on the north. The North has much of the money. It determines what's going to be produced. And so much of what happens in those countries, it's dictated by what we do in the North. And there's a real dependency between South and North. And when we looked at some solutions, we said that really liberation is a very important thing to the people that are in the South, just as fair trade is more important to them than free trade when there are very powerful economic units trading. And they tend to be some of the weaker units. And then the third day, we talked about hunger and said that collective self-reliance was the solution. And so we have dealt with international issues to some extent during this week. But the problem that I've had when I've been teaching is that those who are already very conscious and concerned about justice issues and seem to understand them at home want to start talking about them on a global level. And so either when I teach a group, I usually find somewhere between 5 and 10% of students in a cross-section are ready for global issues. And so when we talk about these global issues, either they get very excited about it, or for many, they're hearing it for the first time, or many of these issues for the first time. And that's a little frustrating because I find that students and those who are hearing these issues for the first time don't get very excited. They find it interesting, very polite, and they listen. But there isn't much desire on their part to really become involved. And for the longest time, when I was teaching, it was always kind of troublesome for me that students somehow couldn't understand why these problems on the international level were so terribly important. And I guess I don't really want to point fingers necessarily at people and accuse them of anything, but it became apparent not too long ago that the major problem is that we do not understand justice very well right where we live. And if we don't understand those justice issues where we are, and I'll get into those later, it's very difficult for us to make the extension to the international level. And so what I was really dealing with was students who just hadn't really thought much about justice issues at all, and not knowing what was happening around them, to ask them to think about people that lived over here in some country or whatever was just asking far too much. So that's the reason why I've come back to justice begins at home. Maybe it's not for all of you who are in here. You don't need to hear it. But if you do go back, or if you get a chance to talk about international issues, I think it's important to realize that a lot of people just aren't ready to hear those issues, and the groundwork hasn't really been laid. I still think it's the responsibility of the church, the responsibility of Christians, to talk about what's going on internationally. As I mentioned the other night, we live in a revolutionary world. Things are changing fast. The poor, the oppressed, aren't happy. They're not always mobilized, but when they are, things are going to change. We look at what's going on in Latin America and just think it's a bunch of rebels and revolutionaries down there, and we become very uncomfortable, and then we tend to look at it in an east-west direction, Soviet Union, United States. We don't look at what's really going on in the struggles for their liberation. However, how did we get independence? I mean, we had a war. We fought a revolution. It certainly wasn't over anything as serious as people worrying about hardly getting any food or medicine or being taken advantage of and being almost totally powerless in some cases. I don't think our issues were nearly that good. But it is a revolutionary world that we're living in. And so we need to prepare people for what's going on. We need to hear their issues and what's happening. The problem is to start at the international and global level is often dangerous when you're dealing with a good cross-section of people. As I said, they're often not ready, and then you feel that you're not going anywhere. So what I want to do tonight is, if I really, as I was talking to somebody this afternoon, if I really had my way, in other words, I was the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, what I think I would do is take our military budget. Oh, by the way, this is not thought out very carefully, so I'm not ready to defend it. Don't attack me too viciously. But I think I'd take our military budget, and I would give everybody in the United States at least one M16 rifle, maybe two. I'd lock them up like we have in these hose houses around here so that they weren't a threat. We weren't all carrying them around. Give everybody plenty of ammunition, and then dare any country to come in and take the United States. Who knows the Decorah area better than the people in Decorah? They never know where we were hiding, where we had food. The guerrilla warfare would be unbelievable. If they wanted to take us, they'd have to blow us away. I mean, anyway, by doing that, then with all the money that was left over, I'd give you all a ticket, and I'd send you to some third world country so you could get into the rural areas and live there for a good 6 months or a year and find out that those people are like all of us. I've had chances to live with people in Tanzania and Kenya, Egypt, and then in South America, but especially Peru, and I know Peru best. They're wonderful people. They're good people. And when you see how they live and you see how we fit into this whole scene, I don't think it would take very long before we would become much better informed, we would understand the problems, and that we'd have a far more just world. Also, if I could give you all a third world experience, you'd never forget it. Very difficult to read, to see it on television, whatever, but to live it, to feel it, to see their hurts, their pains, to see and feel their, understand their causes, would be something that you would live with. Well, that's not possible. At least it isn't possible as long as I'm not a Secretary of State or Secretary of Defense. So what I'd like to do tonight is just look at something that's called the Shakertown Pledge. I don't know if that's been used here at Holden very often. In fact, I don't even know what Holden's stance is on the Shakertown Pledge, whether they are basically supportive of it or not. But I see a lot of similarities between the Shakertown Pledge and what is being done here at Holden. The first time I saw the Shakertown Pledge must have been, I think, about 4 years ago. And when I saw it, I thought, that is an outstanding statement on the part of these people who met in the Shaker Village and took this pledge. And so I used it in a class. And I didn't know much about it, but I used it. And it really went over pretty bad. It just didn't do what I thought it would do. So I moved away from it for a while. But now that I've had a chance to be more involved in peace and justice issues at different levels, I've come back to it. And I like it very much in using it for a framework for summarizing some of the things I do when I deal with international issues. And I'm going to emphasize specifically two points. But before we begin getting into any of the detail, I'd like to just go through the Shakertown Pledge and read the 9 points that that I have on the board. By the way, the Shakertown Pledge is the last chapter in the book by Jim McGinnis, and I've been talking about the book by James McGinnis, Bread and Justice, most of the week. So if anybody did get it, it's kind of a bonus in that that is placed in there. Last night, too, I talked about different types of action we can take. And one type of action is, as I mentioned, acts of mercy when there's a catastrophe. There are acts of justice. We talked about those a little bit last night. Globally, we'll be talking about acts of justice at home tonight. And then the third is changes in lifestyle. This has quite a bit to do with changes in lifestyle. Well, I've got just a brief summary on the board, but I will read the Shakertown Pledge. It shouldn't take very long, but I'll read each point in its entirety. The first point is that I declare myself to be a world citizen or a global citizen. It doesn't mean that we're not U.S. citizens, but we just don't think in global terms. And I think that's a serious problem for people who claim to be Christians, to see everything as a United States problem and how it affects the United States, but not examining what's happening to other countries in the world. I think that's a very important, I just think that's probably the real foundation of this whole thing. Whether or not you want to call it a world citizen, global citizen, I would say just a member of God's creation. We are members of God's people around the earth. So that's the foundation. Second, it says, I commit myself to lead an ecologically a sound life. I haven't said much about the environment and ecological balance. I said a little bit about energy last week, but Larry Rasmussen, that might have been last week too, did say about the importance of spitting into the environment, the ecological system that we live in. And anytime we try to manipulate it, we find out in a hurry that instead of economics, at least in my case, running the environment and telling what we can do and how far we can go, we find that there's sensitive balances which we cannot tamper with. And so it means be aware of the environmental problems that are going on around you and be sensitive to those. The third one, I commit myself to lead a life of creative simplicity and to share my personal wealth with the world's poor. Well, I want to talk to some extent on a life of creative simplicity later in this session. The fourth one is, I commit myself to join with others in reshaping institutions in order to bring about a more just global society in which each person has full access to needed resources for his or her physical, emotional, intellectual, spiritual growth. I call that reshaping institutions. That's probably at the very advanced stage throughout this whole process. We talked about some of the institutions, New International Economic Order, some of the changes at a global level in the past few sessions. The fifth one is, I commit myself to occupational accountability, and in so doing, I will seek to avoid the creation of products which cause harm to others. Looking at one's career. The sixth one, I affirm the gift of my body and commit myself to its proper nourishment and physical well-being. When you're holding, you know that they're concerned about nourishment, good diet, and physical well-being. There's certainly ample opportunity here to get good exercise. I mean, didn't they meet this afternoon on the porch for about an hour? The executive joggers. Seven, I commit myself to examine continually my relations with others and to attempt to relate honestly, morally, and lovingly to those around me. And it's number seven, too, that I want to dwell on to some extent tonight. Eight, I commit myself to personal renewal through prayer, meditation, and study. And nine, I commit myself to responsible participation in a community of faith. The reason why I think the Shakertown Pledge is important is that it does mean that we're talking about some change in lifestyle. Now, one of the three points that McGinnis talks about that I think are very important. Why would anybody even want to consider something like this? The first point that McGinnis says is that changing lifestyle is a slow, step-by-step, daily process. It's a daily process, and it doesn't happen too terribly fast. you don't just jump in to it by making drastic changes. But what happens is, when you get involved in this, works of justice, I can't stress that term enough, works of justice become an everyday matter. So all of a sudden you're concerned about what is just, what is fair, you're worrying about your own body, about the environment around you, about others around you. You start thinking in terms of justice. The problems certainly are overwhelming today when we talk about big systems, changing the international economic order. But what we're talking about here is small changes where we begin to feel what issues of justice are all about. The second thing that McGinnis says is that the pledge brings internal changes. The small daily struggles that you have with lifestyle will either deepen your commitment or it won't. And if it does deepen your commitment to justice by getting involved, action is likely to follow. So we talk about action. Well, it's when you start making some internal changes that you find out where your values are, and it may lead to action. And the third thing that McGinnis says is these small struggles often put us in contact with the oppressed and the poor. And I guess I'd want to emphasize that. If you're doing these things right where you are, you often come in contact with the oppressed and the poor, and it's a wonderful learning experience. When you better understand oppression and injustice, then you're ready to act. McGinnis states at the end of this that actions are the external expressions. So our actions are the external expressions of our inner spirit or vision or commitment. So it's a matter of finding where you are, what you believe in, getting some commitment, some vision from it. I want to say something about 8 and 9, because for example, 1, world citizen, that attitude. There's not much to add. Ecologically sound life, reshaping institutions is probably the final step. I mean, when you're really ready to act, if you're going to make some changes. Occupational accountability is something I'm sure that we've all struggled with at some time or another, or still struggling with. Physical well-being, pretty straightforward. But 8 and 9, I think they're terribly important points, although I don't plan to spend too much time on them. First, personal renewal. When we were at a retreat center about a year and a half ago, they said one of the most important things to do there was to set time aside each day for silence and quiet, where you can reflect, meditate, whatever, on the day, on who you are, and what's going on. They told us that. The only problem was, they ran the place, or we were part of it too, and we planned the program. We ran the place like you run Holden. And we had full boards with bulletin boards of activities to do, plus there were crafts, plus there was hiking, or we had cross-country skiing, it was winter. And we never emphasized that till about the last 2-3 days when we had a session on it. And although I still don't think that I do nearly a good enough job in this area, that is a terribly important part of life. And all of nature rests at certain times, and we need that time to just sit back and think. One of the scariest things to do is to sit with yourself for an hour with no stereo, no book, no television, no nothing. Just to sit and think through some things. It's really a scary thing. But we need that time to think and reflect. I think it's very important that we all try to do that. Silence can be a very good thing. I tend to do mine in a very, I shouldn't be very proud of how I do it, because I'm concerned about conservation. But I like to take about a 20-minute to 30-minute hot shower every morning. But it's a great time to sit and think through things, that nice massage. Here you can sit up in the jacuzzi. So. And then the 9th, to be part of a community of faith. I guess I just think that is terribly important, because you need a support group, and to have a common faith such as the Christian faith is just essential for making changes like this. If you're going to do anything in community, there are very few people who are willing to make or able to take a step where you join a community. And that's really a major step to take if anybody were to do that. There are a number of things they say that are necessary if you ever think of doing it. First of all, personalities. If you have personalities that match, you think, oh, great, let's have a community, and we'll buy a house or whatever, and live in community and work on these things together and have a good support group. The problem is personalities just won't do it alone. You must have a common task. Most people feel that there has to be certain issues that you're working on that hold people together because personalities just can't do it. Secondly, they say you've got to have time to be alone and you need your own space. If you live in community, if you don't have an area where you can go and no one else can step in there without your permission, it's really tough. And third, they say that the faith, understanding the Eucharist, terribly important because most communities are going to be very vulnerable. And you share your brokenness at different times. I mean, there are struggles that you work through. And if you don't understand the Eucharist, it can be a devastating experience. And finally, they stress that it's something that moves very slowly. So I'm not talking right now about joining a community. That's a serious step that doesn't come at the very beginning. But support groups, very important. And of course, I guess if I was interested in a community, we would certainly focus on global justice, I think, is an issue. And I think at some stage it would be pretty interesting to do that. But as I said, it's not easy to find people who share many of the same ideas. And can be some of the struggle. Well, I want to look at number 7. If I were to relabel this, I would say that I would call 7, justice begins at home. I suspect that especially number 4, where you're changing institutions or you're getting into global issues, will never happen if number 7 is not fully understood. And so I want to say just a few things about justice at home. The text, or the theme book here at Holden this summer is Matthew Fox's book on compassion. It's a spirituality named Compassion. Matthew Fox states in there that the one thing that the world seems to be lacking more than anything else right now is a sense of compassion. And as I've said before during the week and last week, I'm very reluctant to look at the world's ills and say that there's a simple solution. Compassion. But in visiting with Mary Schramm somewhat about gifts and how she feels that gifts are to be used for others and you do it in a caring way and compassion sort of covers all of those gifts, I really do feel that is, if there's anything sorely lacking, it's compassion. The ability to care about others and how they're doing and to care enough to want to act. And so I've really, ever since the Fox book came out about a year and a half ago, I've really been excited about it. And I've spent a lot of time looking at it, reading it, and studying it, and trying to spread that message as much as possible. As far as justice at home, I just want to talk about a few examples here. The way we relate to other people is terribly important. And Matthew Fox talks in the second chapter about ladder climbing. And he says that even though, I guess, Jacob may never have climbed his ladder, we have this image in life of ladder climbing, always wanting to move upwards. Those at the top are very important. Prestige. And how do you relate when someone's at the top and someone's at the bottom? You have more of an authoritative way of looking at things. And he claims that that has caused a lot of problems for us as we've tried to all become ladder climbers. He states that what we need is something that has more equity in it. And so he said, let's take Sarah's circle. I believe that's it, Sarah's circle. Sarah, I believe, bore a child to Abraham late in life, at least. And that there was real joy and celebration, and that's where he gets his idea of dancing Sarah's circle. When you dance Sarah's circle, you're all on the same ground. You never go around trying to put yourself above others. So you're on equal ground, you work together, you share, you cooperate, there's always more room for someone to join the circle. And I think there are a lot of good things in thinking about that. And so I want to talk about some different relationships. For me, one of the important relationships is parent-child. It's really, it's for the most part, enjoyable being on the parent side, because you find out, maybe not the first time, but you find out what your real values are and how you think you'd like to see your children grow up. And in that process, we have really worked on how we relate to our children. To what extent can they be involved in decision-making with us? Or are we just simply the authoritative ones, the ones on top, who just say, it will be done like this, done like that? It's really fun to work with them and see how they think. You know, how we relate, trying to go from the Jacob's ladder more to a Sarah's circle. Clearly, that's not possible at all times. But I think the way children and parents relate is terribly important. I've got a student who works in a shelter for abused women. And it's interesting that most of the women who are abused, they find out that their parents or the husband's parents abused the wife. The young children grow up thinking that that's life, that's what it's all about. They don't know anything different. And it's breaking those cycles, the way we relate to each other. That's certainly an extreme example. Let me move to student and faculty. I mean, that's another one I can work with. How do you relate to the students when you're on a college campus? Do you throw your authority around and you stand up front? Is you're really the ruler? Or is it something where we're all in the process? You're trying to learn together. You hear what they have to say. And the ways in which you relate, terribly important. Maybe the most fundamental one is the way we relate male-female. And I'll just briefly tell a story about that one. I'm afraid I was exposed to the male-female issues in the movement for women's liberation in the wrong way. It happened in the late 60s and early 70s when we took a trip to the East Coast and we were around a group of people who were really interested in that movement. And I was told about how we oppressed or put down women in subtle ways or maybe in very obvious ways. But I was told that in such a way that I was just blasted right and left, and as far as I was concerned, just put down even more than I guess I thought I was putting down women. And the manner in which it was done was almost like a flip-flop of Jacob's ladder, and it came at me and I wasn't ready for it, and it was a terrible experience. And for that reason, I had a very negative feeling about it for quite a while. Then I had a chance to be exposed to some women at a retreat center who, in a much more gentle way, I'd say more of the Sarah Circle way, started saying things like, and when I was in school, the teacher would always say, would everybody come up and pick up his paper? And she said, I always felt like they were never talking to me. And it was and when I would hear those stories, it was the first time that I realized that no matter how we interpret his, there were people who were seeing it differently. And I think part of Sarah's Circle and part of compassion is trying to hear what others have to say, how they put down, to listen to them. We have a rule, I'll go back to the family, we have a rule with our children that when we make a decision, if they think it's wrong, they can challenge it at any time. And, you know, it's embarrassing. And my oldest daughter doesn't challenge us often, but when she does, I think she wins about 80% of them. And that's when I realized that too often, in my case, I just make a quick decision without really thinking through how it affects her, what she's thinking, and what are the consequences. And when she sits down and gets a chance to come back and talk to us about it, and you hear the other side, it's interesting how it has often changed her decision. I always tell a story about my second daughter who loses most of her appeals. but she's coming along, and I'm afraid that pretty soon she'll be same situation as her older sister. But the justice, then, that's right where you live, at home, how you relate, male, female, parent, child, faculty, student, white, non-white, students. Well, I could tell all kinds of stories of how students relate to each other in dormitories and that care. If you don't worry about those issues, if you don't think of how your actions affect other people at that level, and you don't listen, what I'm trying to say is it's very difficult to make that extension to the global level. And so I really put in a plea for people to read Matthew Fox. I suppose most of you here don't need to read Matthew Fox, but if you know somebody you could give the book to, I guess I would encourage you to do that. I'm very concerned about this whole issue of compassion, and I'm going to just share a couple concerns now, because if you can give me some feedback, I would certainly appreciate it. I'm concerned about justice, especially at a global level. And I don't know how you promote justice at a global level without developing some sense of compassion. And so I agree with Matthew Fox on that point. But how do you instill in people a sense of compassion, a sense of caring? When do you do that? I'll give you an example. I teach a course in economic development. I try to encourage any students who think they will go overseas to a third world country to take that course. But when I teach the course, I find that maybe 40-50% of the students enjoy the course, and they take it seriously, and it's really kind of exciting. The other 50% plus just sort of listen to it. They're just issues that bounce around, but they don't take it very seriously. So during the years, I sit down, I visit with the students, and I say, why is it that you seem to care so much about these issues of justice? Why is it? And of course, I hope I've told this story this week, the whole last week. Of course, I'm hoping someone will say, well, your class was very enlightening. It really changed me around. I'm just waiting. But they don't say that. They say, something happened to me when I was young. Either because of what my parents were doing or friends, I became involved in some issue of justice. It never fails. And what's happened is they've been thinking when they were young. And when they get older, maybe as you go through high school, you've got all kinds of peer pressure, tough time, and you don't worry a great deal about justice. But when you get into college, maybe you can nurture that seed that was planted earlier. And that's what seems to happen in the courses that I've been involved with. Something happened when I was younger. Well, if compassion is so important to justice, and if we're going to have some global justice and get people to be concerned, because I know there are a lot of people who say, you know, what big systems? How are you going to change it? How is it going to work? If you're going to do that, my big question lately has been, at what point do you enter into a person's life to try and break that cycle? If they aren't thinking about justice, they're not, where's the best time to do that? So we've been interested in topics like parenting, for peace and justice. I'm really interested in the material that they use in Sunday school. If some justice issues and global issues could be used there. We found that our oldest daughter so far has been very receptive to those kinds of issues and seems to understand them. She hasn't lost that sense of compassion yet. Maybe she hasn't watched enough television yet to have lost it. It's easy to watch the television and all of a sudden become callous towards any kind of thing that happens on television and therefore in the real world. Or do you enter at the grade school level? Where does it happen? Where can it best be done? If someone, I want to finish this section, we'll have a little time left over. If somebody would like to respond to that. That is really a pressing need for myself right now, and I would really appreciate some response. Well, I think that if you are concerned about what is going on around you, justice, and you're concerned about justice at home, you will find that your lifestyle too will change somewhat. And number three is creative simplicity. And I want to say a little bit about lifestyle changes. First of all, what is a lifestyle change? I'm not sure that I've ever seen a real good, concise definition. Usually it's referred to as a simpler lifestyle. So far this week, we've heard in some Bible encounters that we should be concerned about sufficiency, that having too much can be bad, having too little can create problems. And so if you look at it from a Christian perspective, a simpler lifestyle would mean that you would consume less. And that if you did that, it would be a very freeing experience. You would also conserve. You would be very involved with conservation efforts. And last week, I know I mentioned that in the process of conserving, a lot of people talk about the five R's. I don't know if that comes, what book I saw that in, but it's before you throw anything away, you either try to repair it, or you try to reuse it, you try to reclaim it, you try to restore it, and you try to reactivate it. And another would be you share. Concerned about sharing.
that we don't need to buy as many things, for example, maybe a lawnmower or a snowblower that doesn't get used very often. He said that can be shared within the community. Well, in this whole area of simple lifestyle, I want to just mention a number of things, like some reasons why I think the person wouldn't want to do it, what it is not, and then just a few characteristics, just a few brief terms that I think are important in characterizing it. First of all, you should really not be involved in any kind of a lifestyle change for the wrong reasons, such as guilt. Some people change lifestyles because they do feel guilty, or they see it as a substitute for political action, or it's in the quest of becoming morally pure, something like that. The lifestyle change really should be out of, a basic love and a care for what's going on in what's happening to the earth and to the people around you, and as a global citizen, how you fit into the planet, where there are so many people, as many as 800 million, who really suffer from some form or other because of poverty. It is really a vision or a dream of a better world. When you make those moves, you make them because you're really serious if you're going to make some changes. And you want to make life better. Second, if you go into lifestyle changes, it's a good way to find out where your values lie, what you can do with and what you can do without. So far, I think we have found that it has been a freeing experience. It's funny how I always heard people talking about a simpler lifestyle. It's just a freeing experience. I always heard that word. But when you find that you're not always worried about how much you're going to buy and how much you're going to accumulate, it can be a very freeing experience. As I have a deep commitment to it because I've lived with people, especially in Peru, who have so little. And I'll never forget that. It's just a part of me. And so for me not to have to worry about accumulating more and more and knowing that others don't have much and that I would be using resources that they may be able to use in the future makes it fairly easy for me not to do it. But I've had a lot of opportunities to have experiences that have deepened my commitment. Also, if you ever take action in this area, the action has to be right for you. I just don't think you can force this in any way. There are areas where you have skills, interests, talents, whatever. You just can't do it all. And you have to make changes where it's possible and then move slowly and have it gradually evolve. One problem that we often have is that people try to be Superman or Superwoman and just do everything, solve all the world's problems and make drastic changes in lifestyle. And I just think that is very, or extremely, extremely dangerous. Now, some things that lifestyle changes are not. I don't think that anybody that looks at a simpler lifestyle is talking about poverty or austerity. Nobody is talking about going back to an austere level, living almost barely subsistence. That's not what it is about. Also, it isn't something that, for many, if you don't hear much about it, it's tempting to say, oh, it's a passing fad. It's something that is just coming and it won't stay here for long. There have been a lot of movements around the world now, and there are many more that are popping up here and there where people are concerned about some changes in lifestyle. The numbers are still small, but a lot of people, many of them out of the Christian community, are very concerned about sufficiency and moderation. I guess it could be a bad term if you mentioned earlier in the week, but just a sufficient level of material goods. It is not anything like back to the land and isolation. The one thing that lifestyle doesn't do is cut itself off, or change in lifestyle, or simple lifestyle, is cut itself off from the world. It just doesn't cut itself off. We're very concerned and involved with what's going on in the world. And although I know some people will say a simpler lifestyle was one of the ways to solve the world's problems, free up more food and all that, I'm not at all convinced that simpler lifestyles are going to solve the world's problems. But what it can do is it frees up some time for people to devote to issues of personal growth, social growth, a better understanding of the problems in your neighborhood and the world around you. One thing I do like about the simpler lifestyle, I've seen it as a very good argument for supporting it, and that is whether you're aware of it or not. And one of the topics I was going to deal with this week is foreign policy, and we just didn't have time. But our foreign policy in rhetoric tends to be based on three things. You know, you have any idea why do we have foreign policy? One is is for security. I mean, the kind of foreign policy we run is to try and ensure security for the people in the United States. And so the military plays a very important role. Second major part of foreign policy is protecting our economic production and profits that we make around the world. And the third part is human rights, trying to promote human rights. Well, if we continue to grow and grow and grow, as it appears that we're going to, at least with Reagan economics, we're supply-side economics and a lot of growth, that just means that securing the resources we need and military will be important, and it means that profits overseas, the Trilateral Commission and those people who are concerned about maintaining profits will be an important part of our foreign policy. But simpler lifestyles might mean that more emphasis could be placed on human rights as we relate to other countries. There's 15 things about lifestyle. Some scary, some exciting. First, a simpler lifestyle is really hard work. I don't know how it ever got the name simpler lifestyle, because it's kind of misleading in a way, but it is hard work. It is not taking the easy way out. We usually refer to it back to, in our area, as a responsible lifestyle, as opposed to simpler lifestyle, knowing that we need consuming less. Second, it's risky. That's the easiest thing to do. Third, it is revolutionary. But if you look at the biblical teachings and this idea of sufficiency, the fact that we have to fit in with our environment and with the people around us, you take the term shalom seriously, of how we fit in with all those in the world, yeah, I think it's going to be a little revolutionary. Fourth, commitment's very important, so I guess I did touch on that. You need to be committed for the right reasons. It tends to emphasize small scale, and I haven't said much about this book, but Schumacher's written a book, Small is Beautiful, and that's really an interesting book for anybody who wants to read some economics and have it pretty easy reading and very stimulating. Sixth, it is oriented more towards the human being. Now, one thing I talked about, not this week, but last week, was economic growth. In the United States, we have tended to put a lot of emphasis on producing more and more goods, economic growth being one of our major objectives because we have unlimited, insatiable wants. And in the process of going after all of those goods, the human being and nature have often been pushed aside. And in a simpler, more responsible lifestyle, feel that the human being becomes much more important. And that's one reason why Schumacher is associated with this whole idea, because the subtitle of the book, Small is Beautiful, is Economics for People Matter. Economics is what people matter. Seventh, cooperation. If that's part of the community there, you need to work together. You try to interrupt spirals of injustice. I haven't said much about that, but it's the way we relate to each other on just grounds, and we need to interrupt those. It tends to be nonviolent. And we haven't had any sessions here, have we, this week on nonviolence. I think there's a community, something coming up in the community soon on nonviolence. And then the last four characteristics, one is that it's creative. I cannot say enough of that. I don't know if when you're around Holden, if you feel that there are some creative people here, they're doing some different things, they're experimenting, but it's a real challenge, and it just brings forth creativity. And it really can be an awful lot of fun to think of new ways of doing things. That creativity is terribly important. And I mentioned it's evolutionary. I've already touched on that too. And it stresses community and then for the solitude. Many of these, I guess, are already in here. Well, this session was on, or the week was on, global issues. As I mentioned, I've ended up on something that has to do with lifestyles and justice beginning at home. I think it's terribly important, because if we're going to make changes at a global level, we've got to start talking a little bit more about the justice issue at home. And so, I don't know. I find it very difficult to sit here and talk from a chair The first week I was in here, I was doing some domestic economics where you have to draw graphs because all economists draw graphs, and I was moving all over. And I feel so much more comfortable when I can move over here and talk and move over there and sit in this chair for a long time. It's really kind of draining. But maybe what I should do is just open it up now. Do you have any kinds of questions, any kind of comments? Does it make any sense? Any ideas you'd want to throw out, I'd be happy to entertain them. Or if you just want to discuss things with each other, that'd be fine. Yes.
I read it for the first time back in November last fall, and that is what convinced me to go into the Peace Corps. And I have been on the fence for about 5 years, and when I saw that, bingo, I must have read it at least 10 times the first time. But I was so excited about it, I wanted to send it to about 3 or 5 of my friends, and I sent the address down in Minneapolis, and it was returned to me. I'm just wondering if you know, if it changed addresses,
yeah. Yeah, I knew some of the people that worked there with they actually started an organization, the Sacred Town Pledge something, I forget, and operated out of the Twin Cities. They are no longer operating, and I know that. I think there may be something out in Philadelphia. I'm surprised that they wouldn't have sent an address, but yeah, I'll try and follow up on that. The thing really is quite radical, but in being here and talking about the Christian religion and the life of Jesus and what he was doing, I guess that we are in talking about revolutionary, radical things and kinds of changes. Maybe I'm too oversensitive. Maybe what I need to do is just keep teaching things on the global level. But I don't know if you can sense some of the frustrations that I do have myself of when you get into groups and you start talking about global issues and the people just don't understand. I think if you understand why a person is hurting that lives right next to you, or if there's someone who is poor is hurting, and you see what it means to be powerless and poor, those same kind of hurts and those same kind of problems and causes of poverty, many of them are the same thing that happen on the international level. And then when you hear the story from a third world country, it's much easier to understand what's going on. By the way, another thing that maybe I should say, I trained myself to work internationally in development. And yet, most of my friends that I talk to in other countries have all told me that we don't really need you to do any work down here. We have our problems. We kind of understand them. We're trying to make changes. We need you to go back home and do some work and teach the people in the United States that there are problems internationally, so that when we try to do something down here, you don't get in our way and mess us up. And so I just got... The longer I was in here, the more and more support I got for coming home and working with some of these things. Well, I think if you begin with those justice issues at home, begin to understand, then you can open up to some of the global issues. Because they are tough. And as I said last night, and I see quite a few new faces in here, we're not going to march down into Latin America and fight the wars for them. But there are a lot of things that we do with our policy that create problems for them. We need to understand them better, yes?
What are a couple of specific things that you did when you began to live a more simple lifestyle? How did you start on that?
I think the most useful thing that we did was at the beginning of the year we try and put together some kind of a list of the things we thought we had to add to what we already had, and then decided that we just wouldn't buy any other things and we'd try and get what we had on the list. And I can remember, I don't know, Sony, was it 3 years ago that we had that list, and on it we had a freezer because we have an enormous garden. By the way, I get more nervous by the day sitting here thinking about my garden back home and those weeds. It was a freezer, and I wanted to buy a motorcycle. But it was to save energy. And I bought an 8-year-old one. And I have not saved energy, and I've spent a lot of money trying to make the thing run. The third one I talked about was I want to take the kids to the road. That's terribly inconsistent with most of the things I talk about, but I wanted to take them to Disney World. But it was to put out a list, and so that when you go do things, you find out what you think you really need and what you don't need. The other thing that we did, too, was we decided whenever we made a purchase that we would buy something of very high quality.
if we could, so that it would be hopefully a once and for all purchase. So for example, when we bought living room furniture, we bought good wood, good furniture, but we bought the ones with the little six cushions in there, so that when the cushions go, we just pull the cushions out, either recover them or put in a new cushion, and we don't have to keep buying new furniture and whatever. So we try it. Sometimes you spend more money. I don't think eating like this. Boy, we don't eat this good at home because we just can't afford to buy some of the fruit that we get served here for all of the meals. So it isn't always cheaper, but those are some of the places where we begin. And just in the way in which you use energy was an important one. Yes?
You know, there's one aspect of this simple illusion you haven't mentioned I'd like to make a comment on, and that's bartering. Most of the people that have grown to a simpler lifestyle have started bartering for services, crafts, any talent that they have for something that somebody else has. And I think that puts a lot into the lifestyle because it also puts you into contact with other people and other things.
Yeah. What is happening is people are starting to move in this direction. There's what they call the informal economy that's beginning to develop. And it's where goods change hands, but they don't go through an official market where it gets rung up on a cash register. And that economy is starting to grow as people move into this area. Yeah, that's a good point. You know, one thing we did, we're not doing it right now, but we did it a few years ago. We had a babysitter pool where everybody got 20 computer cards. Each card is worth an hour. And so whenever you had someone watch your kids, there were like five families in it, you would pay them a computer card for each hour. And then when you ran low, you'd just call them and say, send your kids over here because we've got to build up our supply of computer cards. And all of that took place with computer cards to keep it fair. And it was really an informal economy. And we got to know five families. We got to know some of the members of five families real well. Yes.
One thing you brought out was to let the person that you're helping keep their dignity, and I think we've not done that in the past. And I think we feel sorry for ourselves because we're not grateful.
Yeah, I don't know if you're referring to last night or if I might have said that tonight, but I've learned a lot in working in development in third world countries about working right at home. I'll give you a few examples. We're working with some Laotians now, the Hmong tribe, who was marked for extinction by the people back in Laos, so that we clearly can't return. And I don't run a real tough ship, but I really, I'll do anything to help them with services, but as far as the money goes, we've really been pretty rough in that we insist that they pay for certain things because we know they can do it. And I'm having problems with that because a lot of people think just giving is a wonderful thing to do, and it's just a plain gift when it doesn't necessarily have to be a gift. And I don't want to make myself sound too harsh, but when we worked in Peru, we have just found that gifts are just self-defeating. They destroy people in the long run. They become addictive. They're like drugs. And so I've tried so hard to try and make the people work, not what I would call in any inhumane way, but to work for what's going on, thinking that 3 years from now, when the assistance is cut off, they're going to be much better off than those who have just sat back and been able to receive from people with real good intentions. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not eating or anything like that, but I think that's just a real good point in the way you treat people. You always try and give them some dignity and as much as possible.